Accession number 4423, Reel 6.
Colonel Lewis, Reel 6.
So, very quickly, a message arrived from the adjutant, written. It said, the battalions are at an hour's notice to move. Your company has been informed. You to report to the order room immediately. Bring sufficient equipment for a week. Stay. As far as I remember, there was nothing else. I had no idea what was on. It was then, of course, in the middle of the night, between midnight and 1 o'clock. So I went with my camp equipment down to the oily room, and they told me that there was some trouble at Lagos, but it was very secret. Nobody was to know anything about it. And that my company was parading with full equipment for a week. And in a very short time, the whole battalion was on the road marching to the station. And my wife, who hadn't gone to bed by then, was out in the car doing odd jobs for us, fetching so-and-so, picking up that and that. And she came to the station. She was one of the few white women who knew that we were moving. So we got to the station, and a train came, a big train, and we were all told to get in. Nobody seemed to know where we were going. People said they think there's trouble at Lagos. And the train went off. My wife was immensely impressed by the way this went. And so we were on the train, and before long heard a few rumours, it got round that there was trouble with the police at Lagos. And of course it takes about a couple of days, a couple of nights, I suppose, to go down in the train. And we were told that we'd got priority on the on the railway, that everything was being stopped. And we were being rushed through. Well, we arrived at Lagos, the battalion detrained, and then it was known that the police mutiny. It was very early in the morning, and there were very few people about, and we marched through the town to Lagos, and then according to our plans, we'd worked out with the local military commander in Lagos, he'd got some plans ready. We moved out to various places, took over the docks to stop trouble on the ships, we took over the banks, the principal government offices. We had sentries outside there. We even had my company, if you please, who'd never seen a city, doing police duty in the street.
Was it a success?
Yes. And then we realized that the problem was that the police had mutinied, and they were all in their barracks, armed. They were armed police with their rifles. They refused to allow any police officer near them. There was some trouble over pay. It was a misunderstanding. That was the frightful thing about it. Once they were told the facts, they said, oh, we didn't know that. And they were quite willing to surrender, but that was a long time afterwards. So we had to... Our first objective was to disarm the police. Now, you can imagine, this was a very sensitive business. And I went up to one of the barracks there with one or two officers, and we had there was supposed to be a big meeting going on that day amongst the mutinous police, and I had my company hidden away in lorries around the back in case this trouble broke out, and we communicated to them by shouting. And in the end, we got them to agree that they wouldn't hand over their rifles to any police officer, but they would hand them over to the West African Frontier Force. So we went in and collected their rifles and ammunition.
So there was no resistance?
No resistance. But it was very tricky. I was very anxious because I thought I was going to be in the middle of a real riot there with police firing, because I had these men, these Dacca Kerries, and, you know, it was a heavy responsibility for a few hours while I... until we got the situation clear. But, of course, there were many police posts all over the place, and this formula had to be gone through with each one to persuade them to give up. It became increasingly easy, of course, once you got the thing going. Well, the West Africa, the 1st Battalion of Nigeria regiment were very popular in Lagos amongst the Europeans, I can tell you. We couldn't put a foot wrong after this, because they were very worried down there. There were big tribes near there, pagan tribes, who used to work in the docks a lot. They were very strong and they were very militant. And they were. It was feared that now the police were on strike that they would go on the rampage themselves, these tribes, the Yoruba and various other tribes who were normally working in the docks. Very strong, powerful men, and militant, the rule.
How do you mean militant?
Well, that they were easily stirred up, you know, to physical force. So, I think the Lagos was always aware that this particular tribe, they had given trouble from time to time, and they could be difficult to handle.
Was there a crime wave as a result of the police strike?
I don't know for certain, but there was a great fear of it amongst the Europeans and the authorities, a great fear. I think we saved the dockyards from being looted by our presence. I, for a time, was in the dockyard myself with my company. And there was a lot of stuff there. And we had the gates and we were in control. We could stop people coming in. This went on for a couple of days before it resolved. Well, then I was very interested because I realized I'd brought these very primitive people down who'd never been out of their country. And here they were in what appeared to them, it was a large city. And I was interested to see what their reaction would be. So I told them that I would take them on the, when the trouble was over, take them on the other side of the island, because they seemed to think, you see, the island of Lagos, they thought that just the other side of the water was England, that we could see. It was the mainland or something. So I tell them I would take them and show them the sea one day. So we took them over to the island, over the other side of the island, where the Atlantic rollers were. And there they rarely saw the sea. Well, they all rushed down and tried to drink it. Put their hands in the water and were drinking. And I had to sort of, and various people shouted at them to not to do that. And they said, it's very funny water. And so then I said I would take them on a ship and show them around a ship. So I took them on a big ship, but their chief problem was that they were asking me, are we still on the ship or have we got back on the land? You see, this thing appeared to be so big to them, their concept of a boat, waterway, transport, was a little canoe. So when they boarded one of these big liners, they frequently said to me, but are we still on the ship or have we got back on the land? I said, you're still on the ship. They said, well, I can't believe it. And so it was interesting from that point of view to take these people down and see the reactions of primitive people. We had to keep them under careful supervision all the time, keep them together and under careful supervision so that they didn't get lost or get overwhelmed with what was going on around them once the sort of military side of it had ended and the sort of military discipline that goes on when you're actually operational had stopped. I just wondered how they would relax and how they would react then to these astonishing sights that they were seeing.
And did any of them get into any trouble?
No, none. I brought them all back too. But it was quite an experience, you see. You've got to remember that, I mean, sometimes they brought over Africans to the coronation, say, in London. Well, I knew two or three who were over here for one of the coronations. And well, when I came back, I said, are you going to tell all your people in the villages that what you've seen? They said, no, we can't. And I said, well, good heavens, why not? That's what we sent you to England for, to see it. They said, well, but they wouldn't believe us. They'd think we were mad. They'd say we'd gone home. We'd been sent to England, and the white man had driven us mad. The trains under the ground and all this sort of thing that they'd seen in London. They said, no, I don't think we can tell our people. They say, these people have come back, they're mad. Talking all absolute nonsense.
Why was it that the Dakar Keres were kept in a separate unit? Why weren't they mixed up with the other tribes in the WAF?
Well, one of the chief's requests, when he asked for the government to accept these people, his tribe, for service with the West African Frontier Force, he stipulated that they must be together. You see, their whole tribal life was in one group. They did not go out of their own country normally. You see, they lived together, and therefore the chief thought that this was advisable, to keep them together in a unit. And I had command of the 1st Dakar Kerry Company to come into the West African Frontier Force.
Was that unprecedented in the WAF, for there to be a unit composed of one single tribe?
As far as I know, this was exceptional, the fact that this one company, tribe, tribal arrangement was made. I don't think any other part of the... for instance, the headload battery at Zaria, there was artillery, a headload, you know, the guns taken to bits and carried on the men's head. They were very smart. They were coming to Olympia. Well, they were a special... also a very special, strong tribe. They were, in their normal lives, carriers. In the old days, they were down on the coast, and they did all the carrying to the port, say. In those days, if you were European, you were probably carried on a what do you call it?
Sort of a litter?
What's the word? Sedan chair thing. These very strong men were... it was their function in life to be able to carry loads. And they had been specially recruited into this battery at Zaria, which had head loads. And they were very effective, very smart, effective gunners. They could shoot well. And they were going to be brought to Olympia to give an exhibition, but I think the war came, the Second War, stopped it.
You said that you had to teach your Dakar Keres Hausa. Why was it that you didn't learn Dakar Kere instead of everybody having to learn a third language?
Well, the Hausa was the lingua franca of the North. Everybody spoke Hausa, rather like on the East Coast, everybody speaks Swahili, but they all have their tribal languages as well. But in the northern Nigeria, nearly everybody spoke Hausa. There's a certain amount of Arabic comes into it, and it's well, you see, they had to be in a position where they could communicate with the other soldiery and the other companies and so on, and therefore it was necessary for them to speak Hausa rather than try and teach the battalion to speak their language. I mean, they were a minority group.
I think that in 1933 you were seconded to the civil administration to deal with an anti-locust campaign. Can you tell me how that came about and what you did?
Yes. There was a locust invasion, as you probably know, on the east coast of Africa, there is the desert locust. And on the west coast, there's the red locust. I mean, broadly speaking. And this, I was out one day, and I saw what appeared to be a mountain coming along, a huge thing. It was a column of locusts going right up thousands of feet in the air, blacking out the whole country for 2.5 days. But this was, of course, towards the end of the campaign, when they'd taken to flight their hoppers for 3 weeks. They hop along the ground. They come out of the ground, out of their... each female lays about 30 eggs, and they all come hopping out of the holes, and they hop along the ground for about 3 weeks, I think. And then they take to flight gradually. Well, I was sent to the civil administration, a lot of us were, to help with this locust campaign. And I went down to into the southern provinces, a place called Zangaroo, and met the district commissioner, a chap called Pitcairn. And I said, well, I'd come to help you kill the locusts. So he called me a hopper swatter straight away. He said, oh, you're one of the hopper swatters. So I went to his bungalow, and he said, well, I've got a locust in here, but we haven't seen many, but I have one. So I said, well, this is great news. And he showed it to me. It was in a box. And I said, well, it's the first time I've ever seen a locust. That's what they're like. And while we were admiring it, it flew out and went. He was supposed to be trying to poison it with arsenic that had been sent up by the government to kill these locusts. So we sought news. And I had enough poison handed over to me to kill a whole battalion of soldiers easily. More. And so he indicated an area where some tribal chiefs were available, and he said, would I go out and help them with this campaign? Well, when I got there, there were no locusts at all, and I got no news of any locusts, any hoppers. But after a bit, the news came through. There were hoppers everywhere. They were all over the place. Every day I got more news, huge areas. They were coming out of the ground like water sort of thing, pouring out. And so I started on my poison bait. There's a word called margany, which means poison. And once that word got round, all my factory staff, it was on a sort of rock, in an area of rocks, walked out. They said they were frightened. It was mahogany, poison. This wouldn't do at all. They'd all die. So I was completely frustrated, you see. So I said, well, I'll go and make some myself on the rock, on this huge rock place. So I went up there and I started making this mahogany, this poison. It was mixing poison with the local winnowed chaff, the crop, the maize crop. I had piles of it collected there before I arrived. It was there, great mountains of it collected by the Africans. So I started mixing it, and my factory staff sat round watching, and when they saw that I didn't die, and there was some pay, of course we were going to pay them, they all came back, and they said they would be very willing to work in the factory. So we started mixing this mahogany, you see, where they were chopped. Then we had big oil drums, and they were to carry these oil drums out to these areas where the locusts, where the hoppers were. And so they carried out, and they spread it like chicken food all over the place. We had a lot of drums, hundreds of them in the end. And we were spreading this stuff around, but I realized it was a losing battle because I began to wonder what was happening outside our area. There was another country there, and then up north, who was killing them up there? We killed a hell of a lot of hoppers, let's face it, but there were a hell of a lot of survivors. And by degrees, they all flew off. Which brings me back to when I started, that I was later on riding from Kaduna. I got back to Kaduna, and I saw what appeared to be a mountain coming. It was enormous. It was like Mount Fujiyama in Japan, coming through the... I thought, what the devil is that? I was quite frightened. And I discovered it was a huge swarm of locusts that were coming down from the Sahara. And they blotted out the sun for 2 days in Kaduna. You could just see a red ball of fire, like looking through smoke glass. And of course at night they all came down. And they ate everything. All our beautiful grass went. And in the morning when the sun got up, they started flying a bit and they all went off. They re-massed and went away. But this astonishing sight that I could see in the distance, I just could not believe my eyes. I didn't know what it was. It got closer and closer and closer. Vast swarm of these things. Miles, 2 days passing.